Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we'll be speaking with special guest Adam Rutskarn de Camp, author of the Chocolate Hammer gaming blog, about his long-running political intrigue campaign using the 1970s Boot Hill Western rules. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
And we're back. Before we get into the conversation, everyone, I just want to let you know that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party Chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all of our patrons. And you can join in on that by visiting patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Make sure you get that wrapped up during the show, because at the very end of the show, maybe a little after, around 2:10 Eastern Time, we'll be on Discord to host the After Party Chat, and we hope to see you there.
Yeah, we really enjoy that every week. So, Rutskarn, thank you so much for joining us here on Sunday afternoon. Really appreciate you can make the time for us.
Happy to be here. Always happy to talk far too long about games that didn't take that long to develop.
And thanks to our viewer Adam Flynn for giving us the idea for chatting about. Were you surprised at all to get a contact about a blog article that you wrote 5 years ago?
You know, the thing about tabletop gaming that I think people need to appreciate is that it very much is our cohort's answer to punk rock, in the sense that it's a much smaller scene than it looks. Like, there's a lot of people who are kind of part of it, but like, if you're actually writing something, you have to acknowledge that's going to come back around and you're going to meet somebody who has a strong opinion about it at some point. When you compare the size of my footprint virtually to like Mr. Beast's, I don't have a lot of brand recognition. I'm not going to have my own candy bar, but I have been recognized at conventions because it's a fairly tightly knit community.
That's a nice feeling when you at least get to that point.
Yes. So I wasn't totally surprised. People have gotten in touch with me about this generally positively before, but.
So Dan, I think this is not the first time we've spoken about Boot Hill on this show. Is that correct? I feel like we did this once, didn't we? Or at least we talked about Western RPGs in a broader sweep. Yeah, yeah.
Much like, you know, major bridge collapses, Boot Hill is the kind of thing that comes up a lot because it's hopefully the biggest example of something. Like, hopefully there's not going to be something that's more Boot Hill than Boot Hill. So, you know, you can kind of just always reach to it as the example of being what it is.
So I think it's an interesting example. And to be clear to viewers, right, we're talking about the role-playing game, the Western role-playing game, the first Western role-playing game that originally came out in 1975. And it was written by Gary Gygax and the Bloom Brothers and Don Kay. And this is within the year of the first publication of D&D, right? So 50 years ago, 1974, 50 years ago, we're now celebrating D&D coming out. And within a number of months, they had published Warriors of Mars and then Boot Hill kind of close on the heels of that. So a very early role-playing game by, you know, the really fundamental giants of the field. Obviously known a lot less nowadays than Dungeons and Dragons, but one of the early tent poles of what gaming was going to be like. So it's prominent in my mind personally.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the first printing, like the first rules version of Boot Hill, didn't actually have the words role playing game because it was too novel a genre to be applied to like this miniatures combat game, even though it's intended for, you know, man-sized targets to each have their own names and identities and who could be sustained. There's clearly rules in place for like playing it campaign style where your actions are being made in a role-playing manner rather than as a pure tactical decisions.
Great observation. The phrase role-playing game hadn't been coined yet in that first year, along with a lot of other terminology we're familiar with. So this is part of the thread that I personally am really interested in nowadays, is that we're at a point where the mechanics are all coming out of and really honoring war games. And so you have written a blog about your campaign that is mostly a political, a hard-boiled Western political intrigue game where players are getting involved in town politics, like in a town like Tombstone, Arizona. One of them becomes sheriff. And Boot Hill doesn't have any mechanics. To resolve things like politics or social interactions or narrative gestures or factions or anything like that. So in broad strokes, Adam, what fundamentally worked to use a system that only has wargamey simulation mechanics to make a campaign that's entirely not about that? Why did that work?
I mean, yeah, you put that very well. The game in terms of what's doing mechanically, the modern design precedent, which is probably a bit good one, generally speaking, if you're thinking about making a game to go work from and not the Boot Hill method, is you start with a small pool of stats from which you could extrapolate a large network of values. In Boot Hill, you start out with, you roll a bunch of random values that you then consolidate into only three numbers that matter, which is how fast you are at shooting or throwing things, how often you tend to hit when you throw or shoot something, and how many times can you be hit with a thrown weapon or bullet from a gun that wouldn't otherwise normally be fatal. Because the other thing is that about 20% of the time anyone gets hit by a weapon at all, they die. So the way I discovered this game's existence was, besides just, of course, trawling through Wikipedia for early role-playing games, probably was... I don't know if how much you two read the old Knights of the Dinner Table comics, and kind of like the Kenzer company. I was a teenager, I think, going through some of those, and they kind of did a few pages about it. And the premise of the game, as it was portrayed there, is just that it is a game where your character dies a lot. And as I've discovered, that's pretty faithful to the Boot Hill experience, since it's a war game. What it simulates, like this action of just people shooting each other in these environments, and it only really attracts, tracks things like how movement affects shooting, or like how you're injured attracts shooting. Everything comes back down to these three values: accuracy, speed, strength. Which means that because the way those rules are executed is fairly close to what you would expect, statistically speaking, from this sort of thing actually happening, not even happening in like an action movie, but in the sense that, you know, when people shoot guns at each other, sometimes they just shoot a bunch and nothing happens, or sometimes everyone's dead in moments. And it doesn't even necessarily matter if you're good at being a gunfighter, because any idiot who's just like a little bit more reckless and fast than you can just accidentally clip you in the head trying to get his gun out of his holster. And he could be on your side even. And that's kind of the thing which the mechanics of Boot Hill faithfully communicate. And players figure that out quickly because they see things happen and they see, okay, my expectation of you get into a combat is that you set up, you know, like, is that, you know, we have the house edge, we're the party, we have our tactics, we have our resources we can burn. So this combat in a lot of ways is testing our preparedness more than it's testing like a relative combat skill or relative, like, it's just like it's attrition. It's a question of, oh, we might have to burn two health potions, or I might have to use one of my daily spells or something. Boot Hill, it makes it clear that any time you pick up the dice, you could die. Someone could die. Everyone could die. The whole party could die. So right off the bat, this does something which actually few role-playing games manage to do, which is calibrate player expectations to what you might expect of someone who is in this kind of life or death situation. Something happened in the campaign, which I think it's an interesting example of how this kind of thing can pay off, which is that at one point the players did something, and then the town's deputies arrived to arrest them and put them in jail to put them on trial. And something shocking happened, which is that the players allowed themselves to be arrested and put on trial.
This is a great observation, right? A tent pole for me is that no players will ever, like in D&D normally, will ever fight as ferociously as when they are threatened to be imprisoned. Usually, they burn every resource. They ferociously, like a bulldog, will do anything at all to not be in jail. What you just described, I've never seen in a gaming situation.
Yeah, but it was so natural. Like, it wasn't even a moment that was necessarily hailed in them. Like, it wasn't like everyone was like, wow, isn't this so wild that we're actually being arrested? It's just, no, you're thinking about this like, all right, listen, they've got a normal number of deputies to effect this kind of arrest, which means that, you know, in practice, we could shoot it out and get lucky. But also, any one of these idiot yokels they handed a shotgun to could scoot my head off, you know? This guy doesn't even necessarily know how to use this gun. That just means it's a 20% chance he'll hit me instead of like a 50% chance. And again, one in every five hits is just fatal in this game. It's not even tied to your skill at shooting. Once you hit, you then do a separate, completely unmodified phase, which is always the same to just by hit location. And that's just if you hit somewhere that's covered by hard cover, you don't do any damage. But like if you're just like out in the middle of the street because, you know, you weren't expecting this to happen, you're fucked.
And to be clear for viewers that have ever played Boot Hill, there's nothing you can get around this 20% chance of instant death by advancement, right? Like in D&D, at some point I'll be a higher level, I'll have more hit points, and I'll be immune to like one shot kills. There is nothing you can do in this game. You can have a character that you've run for two, four, five years in theory, and you are still 20% to be instantly dead from any particular injury. There's nothing you can do to avoid that fact.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, all this stuff is nice to have in like a kind of political espionage game, but also, you know, it's not as though the idea of being able to be killed quickly or even in a single die roll is unique to Boot Hill. What I think, there are a couple things about Boot Hill that I also really felt did, however, make it much more effective than any of us were expecting. Just to be clear, we all play story games and OSR games. You know, we don't, like, my groups, very rarely there's people who even have a strong preference between one or the other. You know, we believe in visiting every shelf of the library. We've had lots of systems we've used before for games like this, and they also worked well by having intricate social mechanics or by having other kinds of ways for these kinds of schemes and stuff to interact. The reason Boot Hill worked well is because since this is the only thing there's rules for, and since this is the ultimate outcome or test for anything, well, number one, it means that players, when they're thinking through things through socially, there's not a lot of metagame concern that they rely on. You know, even a story game, which is gives kind of broad latitudes to making your own story hooks and making like your own interpretations of events, ultimately that's going to encourage a specific kind of metagame thinking, because it's going to like the keys that turn that affect where the story is going are going to be near at hand. But when you've got the outcomes of somebody, not necessarily a party member, is shot by someone else, not necessarily even the NPC they're antagonizing, you know, this could all be this. People are hiring gunmen. People are hiring henchmen, and they've got all of these kinds of networks of interactions. But you don't have any mechanics to access above that level. So everything else that's happening, like making handshake deals, like messing with one person, messing with another person, consolidating your power, all that stuff, they just have to rely on their best understanding of the situation for.
Yeah,
and that creates a lot of interesting stress and kind of pressure.
You know, one of the things I thought of when we were queuing up to have this discussion is I understand from reading your blog post that like you started off going down Boot Hill just for the kicks, or help on the library. I don't think you were originally out to make a political intrigue campaign. But I thought like, well, what if I was? What if I wanted to sit down and make a political intrigue campaign? Let me look at my shelf. What game am I going to necessarily?
You
and frankly, I was kind of scratching my head. I mean, I'm scratching my head to come up with anything, honestly. I'm looking at it like, I don't know, what maybe Fate or
there have been a few Powered by the Apocalypse games that have good I think fairly good political mechanics in them. And those were the ones that came to mind off the top of my head.
Right. And then obviously there's like story games, right? I'm thinking of, you know, especially with the Western theme, you know, maybe we're gonna dust off now I'm forgetting the name of it. Anyway, but like I think a lot of those games also try to leave blank space for this kind of interaction, right? Not necessarily mechanize the interactions, but leave blank space for it. So I think it's fascinating to just come around to like, okay, well, really any game is probably fine. I think the most political intrigue games I've ran have been in Warhammer Fantasy RPG, which frankly doesn't really have any skills, has a few percentile skills for some of this stuff, but not really. Just most of it is like at this point we're just talking and letting the chips fall where they may.
Definitely another key element where, you know, you can sort of get this certainly, if not a guide to picking a game for your political RPG campaign, it's definitely a guide for using Boot Hill for your political RPG campaign. But one of the things that also worked really well was because NPCs are generated from a fairly limited window of stats to be equivalent to player characters and to be fully playable on the mat. And these things were very easy to randomly generate. I, with my fairly limited scripting experience, was able to make a batch NPC generator. And by doing that, I was able to create a stat block for every NPC in town, effectively. You know, if not literally every single miner or every single person who just is employed in the town, then certainly a representative sample of every demographic. So that, you know, if you're doing a deal with this character, there's no gray space where it's unknowable what other forces are interacting with this deal. Like if I make a deal with a hardware store owner, it's not a question of like, well, is the hardware store owner in a position to betray you or not? Because, you know, I maybe haven't thought about that as the GM. Since I have all of the NPCs, I can kind of prearrange everything into like camps and groups and like Venn diagrams. So you can have the sense of like, when you interact with the system, the way it interacts back with you has perfect information. Like it can kind of give you more to work from because everything you do has the appropriate kind of chain of consequences.
Interesting.
I don't know how much sense that made.
Well, one thing that you said in your article is that there is among the half dozen primary stats, I guess there's five, look at my book here. Among the five primary stats in Boot Hill, there's bravery. And you wound up really kind of anchoring a lot of your personality decisions based on the character's bravery stat, I guess.
Well, that because it seems like in a situation where there's lots of different camps or trying to consolidate power, really bravery and ambition may as well be one and the same thing. You know, for most characters, at least, bravery should correspond to how much they're willing to risk and how much they're willing to get involved beyond that. And then, of course, that's true for characters who are likely to be the victims of the conflict. But there are also people instigating the conflict who would have low bravery scores. And I would sort of think about that in terms of, okay, so they must be ensuring their hands are clean here. Like they must be making sure that this can't come back on them. They're only going to strike through like proxies, through allies, you know. And it created a good way to also create levels of threat, to create like a more kind of balanced environment for players to be moving into. Like, because it screens out like the possibility of every enemy having a reaction to every move the players make.
Who was ultimately more dangerous to the players, the people with the high bravery or the people with the low bravery?
As it happened, the people with the low bravery were the biggest primary or the biggest like secondary threat. It was people with low bravery who liked what the players were doing the least because it was the most disruptive. And the characters with the low bravery who were most influential were a coalition of railroad tycoons and silver mining interests that like had created a syndicate for businesses in the town, which the players were threatening to disrupt. not because of any virtue or anything, but just because they represented a different syndicate of criminals. That's the nice thing about like silver mining towns is that there really are no heroes amongst the people in the town. Everyone there is out to screw somebody.
Yeah, I see that. I see that.
Let me ask you. I want to get back to this, like the lack of rules encouraging the style of play. Like, at what point, as you were playing Boot Hill, did this emerge? Like, is it only in retrospect that you were like, "Oh, it turns out that this was great for political intrigue," or at some point did you make was there a light bulb moment where you're like, "This is the game we're playing"?
It was the light bulb moment. There's intuition to it. So the first time I brought it out for players, we just did the pre-baked scenario, which is the shootout, the OK Corral, which historically speaking, it's a case of like a 30-second gunfight where something like 60 bullets were shot and maybe a few people were hit, one or two people died, something like that. Not so much the version we played. That was about 12 seconds long and four people died gruesomely. One seemingly blown in half by a shotgun. It was devastating. It was like five lethal hits on a single die roll. And that was kind of just a bit moment of like, okay, let's see how dumb this gets if we all make our own characters. And then they kind of set themselves a goal, which had an interesting consequence. Like they ended up like clearing out a saloon run by there's kind of a, I was basing Crime Syndicates on the cowboys, the local kind of cattle rustlers and just bad men of that area, and they cleared out like a saloon full of them, and I got access to a whiskey still. And from there, they're kind of like, oh, well, if we have this whiskey still, we can make money with it. And that was interesting enough. But I think also, once they realized their characters had actually survived the first two gunfights, and it was no longer as funny for them to die as it was interesting for them to live, that's when things really started to pick up. Once players kind of got the confidence that, okay, if I play intelligently, I'm not going to be in danger every 50 seconds. It's not that kind of campaign. Yeah. So let's try to minimize the trouble.
Immediately before we started the stream here, we asked the question, like, who of the three of us have actually played Boot Hill? So
yes.
Paul, have you played Boot Hill in the past?
Never played it, never read it. I know nothing about Boot Hill. I'm here as a stand-in for our viewers who are like, what are you doing?
I tell you what, it does not take long to create a character in Boot Hill. No. It's like,
well,
six raw
die
rolls.
We could, yeah, that's
I mean, old school D&D, and it's interesting that Boot Hill is a contemporary of original D&D, which frankly also had a reputation for being highly deadly. Maybe not nearly as bad as Boot Hill, right? But certainly it's one of the things that people will call out about old school D&D is how incredibly deadly it is.
Random encounter for like 300 orcs in the middle of a tunnel. That's just as dangerous as a gunshot, in my opinion.
I mean, there's a great video out there from a song made a million years ago about always the first to die, right? About the player who gets stuck playing the magic user with only D4 hit points, and they just die over and over and over again. I think definitely, you know, old school D&D already has that reputation. Boot Hill maybe even more so. But I've played some other Western games. I played a lot of Deadlands. I've run some political intrigue games. And again, my experience with political intrigue games was that they happen despite the rules rather than as a result of them.
I'm certainly not ruling out the idea of a system that has an excellent mechanical function that like creates a greater sense of immersion in that kind of intrigue game than something that is less mechanically involved. To be honest, I'm not sure I have played it. Definitely, I've enjoyed a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse political systems, but the ones that I've developed or that I've enjoyed the most often kind of do incorporate like more meta-narrative layers than just like, would this work? They kind of have ambitions beyond that. Sometimes it's nice to just kind of like get down to that level of decision making.
I do think there's a parallel here just of like the way, if you look at old school D&D, the way it's written is really about the mechanics without talking about the values or goals of the game itself. Right? I feel like you don't see that in D&D until later editions. And maybe, I don't know if that's because it wasn't...
Guy Jack's definitely stuck his oar in, especially like in the DMG about, timekeeping.
That's true.
Precise timekeeping is necessary to enjoy your role-playing experience.
Sure,
thank you.
Sure.
That's the centerpiece on our bingo card. We need to have that every episode. And so, Adam, I'm so glad you got to deliver the mandatory...
Precise time records are necessary. That's exactly. Is that a running joke in this series?
It usually comes up.
All right. Referencing the precise timekeeping is necessary.
That's a fine addition. We can all theism, right? Like that's not in the little brown books.
Yes. Right.
Anyway, proceed, Dan. You were talking about like what our backgrounds was. I think I want a bit of.
So I did, right. So I was a player. In probably junior high school, which would be, I think, 1980-ish. And I have a copy here. I think it's the second edition that the first edition was just a little book, was just a little brown book, like original D&D. The second edition, like they were doing around late 70s, big color box, this big map, comes with dice.
That's what I've got.
I still have my icosahedron percentile dice that are almost entirely round, right? Very soft plastic, almost entirely round percentile dice. You're welcome, Paul. So if I was to make a character here, it would take a while because they're still rolling. I'll come back to that when they stop at some point. And so we had a kind of a nice expansive campaign going with a whole bunch of players that didn't play together, right? So we were interacting with the referee, maybe once a week, giving a message about like, here's what I want my character to be doing in town. And sometimes they would engage together or in opposition, or some players would just never run into the other characters. And, big surprise. So I wrangled two of my friends to be a criminal enterprise gang, and we were robbing other characters and robbing an incoming stagecoach and robbing a bank and rustling cattle and stuff like that. And the thing that you're making me remember, Adam, is that we never fought fair.
Yeah.
Every engagement was carefully crafted, usually by me, to be entirely an ambush in our favor. And never, ever, ever fight fair. So we always had cover, and we were always ambushing somebody else. And it was really important. And I remember a particular moment robbing the bank of like, it's really important that I not show my body as I move to another position to get like a particular shot. It was like, I don't want to even be in the open for even a single round. Seemed critically important to me at the time. And just as a side note, what wound up happening is, There was another player that I think was the town sheriff, who of course we murdered. And so that player came back, kind of in real life, kind of furious at us. And so made a character that was a bounty hunter whose goal in life was to track down the Jones gang, which was us. Come into town, track down the Jones gang, immediately shot down by us, killed. And so wound up in this cycle of recurring characters that for some reason had a grudge against the Jones gang coming in and being slaughtered by us over and over again, because they partly because they were trying to play like a movie where they wanted like a noble, showdown at high noon, and we were playing a different game. And so I remember very, very quickly having that same kind of interaction with the Boot Hill rules when we played.
There's that premise that, despite Dungeons & Dragons influences, obviously, including Lord of the Rings, you could not use OD&D to play a Lord of the Rings campaign. It would very quickly feel like something else. Similarly, you could not quite use the Boot Hill rule set to create almost any Western, until about the 70s when it came out. Like, if you use this for, like, a Bonanza campaign, it would be a gruesome mess. it would be the end of the golden age of the Western fiction.
Nice. You would not get 20 seasons of Gunsmoke out of it.
No. You would not get to the first commercial break. People would have to guess what the best laundry soap was. They would never find out. They'd turn off the television for the first ad read.
I mean, you know, talking about media influences, when I listen to you two talking about these campaigns and read the article, I mean, what it sounds like a lot to me is the show Deadwood. Was that on when you were running the game? And was that influential?
No, I played this campaign something like 2015. So I've been playing role-playing games since about, I guess it'd be about 25 years now. But I would say it's only maybe the last 10 or 15 that I've really been able to... I've both been in a place like where I'm wondering, okay, what else is out there that I can try? And where it's also been available to get. And to be honest, I kind of wonder if we're not on the other end of that curve. If it's not harder to find older games now than it would have been for a lot of archiving or pirate or torrent sites went down.
Interesting.
My experience my recommendation is if you're interested in old role-playing games, collecting as many PDFs now as you can, probably not a bad idea, because a lot of the sites that archive this stuff are winking out one at a time.
You know, on our Discord server,
somber notes,
we have a debate that goes back and forth about issues like that. And a week or two in the spring, I had a stream. So for what it's worth, coincidentally, this year I've gone back and I've been running a classic Star Frontiers campaign, also by the makers of Dungeons and Dragons, and it was their science fiction game that came out around 1983, I've been really enjoying running it, frankly. I had a stream where I was duplicating the miniatures for it. And we had a conversation on Discord about what's the best way to archive those classic miniatures? Should you actually physically get them and physically store them? Or would it be better to 3D scan them? Or is that actually harder to preserve long-term for, you know, the 40 years that we are from when the miniatures were originally made? So it's an interesting question about whether those digital products are actually robust super long-term. And we have a big question mark about that these days. So it's a really interesting question about those sites that like you, Adam, I've been depending on for quite a while now. If they're not long-term, that's really kind of distressing.
I think physical and digital archiving are both critical. There are people who, you know, take books apart and scan them in. That's an important part of archiving. And there are people who take scan books and print them out and put them in binders. And that's also important.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Let me touch on one thing that you brought up earlier. So granted that when you get hit in Boot Hill, there's no way around it. There's a significant chance you're just instantly dead and that you can't level past that. And there's no healing and there's no resuscitation. There's just no way around that. Other than then don't get hit in the first place. On the other hand, you mentioned that, you know, there are gunfights where a whole bunch of bullets fly around and nobody gets hit. And yeah. I've been finding the same thing in Star Frontiers, that people can even if they start off with a relatively high, like on their sheet, a relatively high base hit chance, once you add in the systems like range and movement modifiers, that immediately craters. And so we have a lot of shooting situations where their sheet says 50-60% chance to hit, and I do the math behind the screen, then I announce your chance to hit right here is 15% or maybe 5%. Yeah. And I've had a lot, you know, I've had significant pushback from at least a couple of players that say I'm only like I'm within the span of the room that we're standing in. I'm within 20 feet, and you're telling me I can't shoot somebody on the other end of this kitchen at more than a 15% chance. And the interesting thing, and I actually didn't say this at the time, but the interesting thing is that that before I ran the game, I actually did some, you know, research into this. And if you look into, you know, real life data, for example, like maybe from law enforcement agencies when they have shooting incidents, even people that have been trained at point blank range, it's like a, it tends to be like about 15% chance to hit, frankly. And, diminishing from that, if you get out of directly face-to-face contact. So it's an interesting, so for me, you know, when I dig into these classic kind of simulationist games, I always think that it's, I always think that it's beneficial for me personally that I, hey, I just learned something about the world that I didn't know about actually. But there's this tension where the players, you know, the players that I have currently frequently expect something more like a movie, more like a piece of fantasy literature. And we kind of have this tension here about whether what really happens in real life is palatable at the game table, because they actually didn't believe it when it was happening. And I was, I was kind of happy to let them grapple with that. Did you find that same tension?
I think that's something that can come up a lot. And it, I generally, to me, the solution lies in the framing of the mechanics more than the what is necessarily happening with the mechanics. You know, so like for Boot Hill, like if you're missing, the goal as the GM is to communicate why that's happening. Like, is to communicate what's going on. Like, so, okay, so if the movement's like negative 20, or like, you know, you have, try to have to like give some like, okay, you know, like yeah, you, you see like a blur, and like there's a flash of gun smoke blinds you, you know, you're you feel something whiz past your ear, and you feel the gun go off in your own hand. You were looking at where he was a moment ago, but now you see that, like, you know, you've blown a window apart. You don't even see where he is, because he was like jumping, and you see like his foot slide behind like a bookcase or something. You know, it's like you try to like sell the madcapness of the moment, and that could sometimes, you know, be a fun challenge, I feel like, as a to narrate. But yeah, that I think definitely it becomes much more important to, like, whenever players feel something is bullshit, one thing that I really like to remember as a GM is that that could be on me. You know, sometimes like I can, like sometimes I, like, I think my favorite example is the, like, if you've got players who like have a locked chest and there's some books in it that they need, and so they try to open the chest by casting fireball on it. Like, that's your classic example of like players doing something where you're like, that's a dumb thing, you know, it's gonna burn right, the books. But you don't necessarily remember the time a week previously where they, like, they were in a locked room and somebody opened the locked room with a fireball and didn't damage any of their spell books or any of the papers in there. You know, it's a question of just like ensuring that what the players see in their heads is like what's going on mechanically, as well as like what's going on, kind of what you would expect to be going on.
That's a good point. That's a good point. But the, and consistent like that.
Yeah.
So
consistent. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say that any system that introduces huge swingy mischances is going to develop some player expectations and superstitions. You're going to get a new religion by the end of that campaign.
Yeah, yeah, I don't mind, and they're finding, you know, they're finding other things to do that are more likely to succeed.
Yeah,
and without getting into it, I don't mind that. Frankly, I don't mind that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you
and
know
the other thing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, and the other thing that I think is synchronous with what you're saying. So you're talking about the fact that, you know, Boot Hill specifically doesn't have mechanics for story elements or social elements or anything like that. And the thing that I've been delighted to accidentally, because you say in your blog that you started the Boot Hill campaign as a joke, that initially it was just a war game and they got a still, and now all of a sudden we have a campaign. And the accident for me with Star Frontiers is that you know, not having the rules available, I didn't give the players the rules. They just never had access to a rule book. And I didn't actually have a lot of time to study or read in advance. So we've mutually been discovering how to play the game in the sessions as we go forward. And I wind up having to like look up a particular skill and explain to them what the options are as we go forward. And Star Frontiers has a little bit of social mechanics. There's a personality ability for everybody. There's a biosocial skill, but it's very lightweight. And I find that not having a bunch of the players can't think mechanically. They can't think about the rule X is this and rule Y is this and how can I put them together. They just don't have any option. They've got to think in character about what can I say here? What can I actually say, or can I find a gift or something like you're talking about, Adam, of like they have to make their best guess immersively from the perspective of the character themselves. And for me, I find that it's a lot more immersive that we're just talking about things that the characters are actually themselves aware of. And we're not talking about meta mechanics that pull us away from where the characters are. And I actually find that avoiding those kinds of mechanics is actually increasing our level of immersion in a way that I've been really delighted by. Does that match your experience?
I would say that when there is mechanics and when there are players who are when players are making decisions based on mechanics, or when they're making it based on their own kind of instinctive read of a situation, it's going to be very much a matter of like, well, what ends up working? And when you've got a system where having like an intuitive approach works, and where players feel like they can navigate the world, and where they can understand and expect what will happen when they do something, as long as the mechanics support that, I think that's a very excellent way to play a game. Whenever you've got the sense that I don't have to like think about this in mechanical terms, I have the option of evaluating it rationally and kind of immersing myself within the situation and just feeling that the mechanical outcome will follow those expectations. Like that's fantastic. It's I think that is one of the most immersive kinds of experience you can have role playing. I think that there's something to be said for mechanics which are just very finely tuned so that they themselves just produce interesting outcomes, so that you're thinking in terms of the mechanics and what outcomes you want to produce. But it's not nearly as immersive. It's a different kind of storytelling experience, I feel.
You know, I feel like this is why I think, and Dan, you and I have talked about this, and I think you agree with me that like I really enjoy playing D&D with people who have never played D&D or even have never played a role playing right. game before. And I'll always say that they have this liberating ignorance of the rules, right? That their actions are not confined by knowledge of how the rules work. It's one of the same reasons like I kind of like shake my fist at the introduction of skill systems into D&D. Like once there's a bunch of stuff on a piece of paper, people just get confined into that. And so by being ignorant of that, I find really liberating, makes a very immersive experience. So I'm kind of curious. I'm going to fold this forward into an actual question for you, I swear. Sure. Which is just this. Like, how replayable do you think your experience is? Like, you go back to the same group and have just as good of a political intrigue campaign, or is the spontaneity of the experience part of what made the magic there?
That group, absolutely. I very happy to say that I've been blessed with some wonderful groups. We can make almost anything interesting. I'm currently many of the same players running a campaign using the top secret TSR rules, which to me feel very much like a successor to Boot Hill in a lot of respects. They kind of carry a lot of the same mechanical observations and insights forward, which I don't think it's going to rival 5th edition or the upcoming D&D edition in terms of popularity, but
do you think that group would intentionally like turn a blind eye then to the mechanics or just be thrilled to not have the mechanics and dig into the story aspects of it, or would they is there any concern that because they had the experience once that they will be now looking for like, well, how do I manipulate the system to
I think one of the advantages of having a system which, again, where the final most dangerous outcome is ideally divorced from anything you're directly doing mechanically, where most of the time you're forced to interact with the setting rather than with like the outcome, I don't think there's any real chance that they could just abuse that. No, I think that they would have be in exactly the same situation, because ultimately, if it gets down to a gunfight, they can optimize as much as they want. It's dangerous. So the thing they're doing, which is avoiding the gunfight, or at least avoiding them being present in it, that's they're going to have the same tools, which is to say, just their best understanding of the situation. Of course, it's very important as a GM to ensure that, like, it's a case of, like, anything that is in the world that is not directly narrated to the players is something in a dark room. So having the NPCs all figured out, having all the kind of the mechanics figured out, that kind of like gives shape and structure to that darkness, so that when they throw a rock, it will bounce correctly off of things in that darkness, and they can start to understand their context broadly. And the thing about that is that it's very hard to optimize that kind of play. That kind of like understanding a larger system by interacting with it and predicting the outcome of the system, that's something that, you can't really like optimize that the same way you can optimize a build.
I love that. I love that observation.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I wanted to get in here. Okay, come on, Paul.
Sorry.
Take that question.
I had to add that quick follow. Would you do it again? Was it enjoyable enough that you would dust off Boot Hill and
I actually tried to run a campaign directly after that was set in the 1970s using the same rule set. That one didn't quite go further. That one was going to be, the idea was it was going to be set in the same county, but because it's 1970 rather than 1870, the genre is not Tombstone so much as Texas Chainsaw Massacre. bunch of like serial killers running around in the Boot Hill system. So it's a question of like, not so much like, do I piss off the sheriff, as like, is that guy looking at me funny across the bar part of this like ring of masked chainsaw murderers or not?
Wow. Fascinating.
I still intend to run that at some point. I did run a kind of a variant of that at a convention. Never got to finish that campaign, unfortunately.
So one thing that I wanted to ask about is of course, Boot Hill is a percentile system. And again, just a couple months, it's got Gygax's name on it. It's just a couple months after D&D. And it's funny that, you know, around 1980, so late 70s, early 80s, it looked like every role-playing system on Earth was going to go in this direction of a roll-low percentile system. And you've got Boot Hill, you have Star Frontiers, you have Top Secret is percentile based, you have Warhammer Fantasy and 40K, you've got Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, like everything was going percentile based at the time. And personally, it works for me. I like it quite a bit. I actually like the percentile roll-low system quite a bit. You know, when it gets to the players rolling, there's no arithmetic on their end. I'm finding that's really important for certain casual players. There's a very straightforward system for, you know, rolling against your ability scores. It's just like completely obvious how that's going to work. You don't need a secondary stat based on your ability score to make that happen. Percentages are things that are a real world metric. It's not a term of game art that anybody should be able to understand. So I like it. It's working for me in a lot of ways that I really like. And it's funny that obviously gaming, maybe at the same time that they got away from simulationist mechanics, walked away from that kind of system. So if you're going to play, if hypothetically Boot Hill was just exactly like it is, except change what dice got used, would your preference be the percentiles, or would your preference be some other kind of dice mechanic to make that happen?
Well, in terms of dice, and in terms of what is most kind of effective at this kind of game, what I would say is that probably the reason we didn't see as many percentile systems over the years is that systems that have curves kind of naturally lent themselves to more interesting mechanical experiments, or like people like, it's not necessarily that you couldn't achieve the same effects with percentile, because it's you can do anything you want within the realm of 1 to 100%. It's just a question of like the form factor of using dice pools or like kind of working on adding dice, naturally led people to insights about curves of probability and of those being kind of easy for players to kind of pick up on and like kind of build expectations on. So I think for Boot Hill, I've done lots of different experiments trying to use different dice systems with Boot Hill. It's kind of become a favorite guinea pig of mine. I'd say the best mutant dice system for Boot Hill was based on D6s, where which number on the D6 is considered a success is modified by circumstance. And what I discovered is that creates the same kind of like broad expectations of like, okay, if I have to like remove a die, that gets across the idea that shooting while running is much less successful than shooting while standing. And I think it produced roughly the same probabilistic outcomes as using the set, like kind of two hit penalties and modifiers. So that was kind of what I worked with that worked the best, I think.
Interesting. Fascinating. If you had to pick, if you were to run another campaign just like it, would you do that or would you go back to the percentiles?
It's hard to say. One thing I've kind of come to think after messing around Boot Hill so much is that you may as well just run Boot Hill. You could probably like try to like internalize some design choices, or you could if you're going to make a Boot Hill for like the next generation or a Boot Hill that you could build on, you might want to like gut it. But as it is, it's a nice jalopy. If all you're planning to do is go into town with it, you may as well just go into town with it. You don't need to change out the engine. I think it's a perfectly serviceable system.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's good advice.
Yeah, I mean, it's good enough is good enough is great advice when it comes to role playing games. I think working on how you run it, and I think working on your sort of how you gel with your group is 9 times out of 10 it's going to yield more benefits than even running a good system versus a bad one. I think we've all had a great campaign and a terrible system. So a game that's good at some things is going to be good enough 9 times out of 10.
Nice. Well put. Do you have any other projects that you can tell us about that you're working on?
I guess this is a kind of a long streak from Boot Hill, but I released a RPG on DriveThruRPG called Deniable Assets. It's a cyberpunk. So it's the cyberpunk villain game. The idea is that your characters are like the bad guys in RoboCop. Like you're the suits at the cyberpunk corporation who are like trying to screw each other over and climb the corporate ladder and get the big promotion to the executive board. And the kind of the twist of the system is that effectively every character is guaranteed an unhappy ending. By creating a character and making a villain, you've made it clear that your character is not going to have your character is going to have a villain's ending. You either get killed or arrested or something or fired trying to make it to the point where you can like try to shoot your shot for the executive board. When you do that, it's called shooting the devil. If you roll poorly, your character gets taken out in the worst possible way because you went up against somebody powerful and lost. And if you win, you become the new executive, who's like the kind of the campaign's executive, like bad guy. And so the next person to reach the top of the ladder is going to take out that character. So it's kind of like you've just put your character in the king of the hill position where they're going to be the next one knocked off. The only character who can have a happy ending is one of the playbooks, the innocent, who has the option of trying to quit instead at the end of his moral arc. And if he succeeds at quitting, that's kind of a happy ending. But otherwise, just all downhill. Other than that, I'm not really working on anything much at the moment. You may also enjoy, unfortunately, probably the most successful role-playing game I've ever created, which is the unofficial Highlander 2 The Quickening RPG. Also available on chocolatehammer.org. That is a game where you play a writer's room who is trying to write Highlander 2, the film, based on pitches thrown out by the GM. You have, yes. The rule is that you have 60 minutes. The first 30 are for coming up with the entire outline. And then from there, you have to do table reads as the characters, where everything you say is finalized dialogue. That's a good convention game. With it, people do it so that like you go up and you like present the whole thing, like all of your scenes, like you write them down and like you just kind of like act them out in front of everybody. I've unfortunately never seen it done that way. I've only heard of this, but it sounds like a good time.
Amazing. That's genius. Great. So Highlander 2 RPG, that's on DriveThruRPG?
No, that is on my, that's free on my website. I have not had the guts to try to charge money for the unauthorized Highlander 2, the quickening role-playing game.
Okay. Makes sense. But deniable assets, right? Your cyberpunk game, that is on DriveThruRPG, and we have a link to that in our chat right at the moment.
Fantastic. Oh, by the way, the rule for the Highlander 2 RPG is if you've seen the movie, you cannot play it. You can only run it. If you've seen the actual movie Highlander 2, you're not allowed to play.
Yeah, that's you know what? I love the original Highlander. There was a quiz the other day about which of these movies is, you know, would be your favorite. I'm like, Highlander, that's the one. And I've never seen Highlander 2, so I can totally play that. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's an experience. There's another portion where after you come up with your fake movie, the GM asks if you think it was dumber or less dumb than the real Highlander 2, The Quickening. And then after they take that poll, they explain the plot of Highlander 2, The Quickening and show clips and then ask again. And they send those results into me. And what generally happens is that everyone thinks their movie's more stupid until they hear what the actual movie's like.
That's amazing. That's inspired. I'm so glad you told us about that.
We are just about out of time here, so I'm going to have to call it on that. Any final thoughts on Boot Hill for intrigue role-playing games?
Yes. If you're going to take time to program a random NPC batch generator for a game, you should probably just accept your relationship with that game is permanent. That you will never have a period of time where that game's not going to live on in your... You may have moved on past that game in your head. You have not moved on past it in your heart. That level of effort
5 years,
makes something important.
5 years down the road, some random podcasters might email you out of the blue and say, hey, we want to talk about this.
By putting this energy into the universe, I accept it unto myself.
We all get called out. Massively called out by that. Jeez.
No. That, I will say, I've been very happy with the results so far.
Dan, any final thoughts?
I'm so glad we got to have Adam on today, and I think it's a really surprising twist that not having narrative social storytelling mechanics actually frees you up to be more immersed in the character. That's what I've been finding lately. I agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's a great observation. Viewers, if you have any thoughts on using a system that is pure deadliness with no rules for social interaction for your political intrigue games, or other cases where perhaps immersive play was a result of lack of mechanics rather than the presence of mechanics, please leave us a note in the YouTube comments here. We'd love to hear from you. Possibly that will spin up some thoughts for the next show, and we'd love to discuss it.
Absolutely. And of course, remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all these sites. So please look for us there and blast that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files at our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, through various podcasts, carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those other sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 about classic D&D and new D&D and science fiction and westerns and miniature making, all kinds of stuff like that. We just have the best patrons with the best ideas there. And of course, huge thanks to, we'll be there for the video after chat in about 10 minutes or so. Again, huge thanks to Adam Rutzgarn de Camp. Really appreciate getting to chat with you today, Adam.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.